I love a strong woman who has some big decision to make or somebody who's trying to figure it out, because that's who I am all the time. No matter how successful I am, I'm always just trying to figure out who I am and what my purpose is.
Karen Gist is the showrunner of a new TV comedy called Mixed-ish. It looks at life through the eyes of a 12-year-old mixed-race girl. Also on the Frame weekend, when writer Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa watched the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, he heard echoes of a play that he'd written years earlier.
And there's one scene in the play, in the second act, where the accused and his victim, the girl, give testimony. And it was mind-blowing.
And this... Everyone is watching the World Cup, so why can't Hollywood make a great soccer movie? It's the Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. Stay with us. I'm John Horn, and this is the Frame Weekend. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do, and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. A little later today, a former NFL player who reinvented himself as a director in Hollywood, and he's written a children's book. But first, Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa is a playwright and a TV producer, and he tends to focus a lot on adolescence. In his series Riverdale, his script for the remake of the movie Carrie, and at Archie Comics, where he's a key creative. More than 10 years ago, Aguirre-Sacasa wrote a play called Good Boys in True. It was about an elite prep school and a male student who was caught in a sex tape assaulting a woman.
It kind of unpacked themes of privilege and sexuality and toxic masculinity and responsibility. And when I heard that the Pasadena Playhouse was looking for a play to produce, I sent Danny, the artistic director, a copy of the script, and he read it and he said, "Did you just write this?" And I said, no, I wrote this, 15 years ago, but I've never gotten the right production. I've never got a production that has realized everything I want in the play. And he said, "Well, let's try to give you the right production."
How recently did you decide you wanted to revisit it? And were there certain things that were happening in the world that made you think that way?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that was happening was were the Kavanaugh hearings. And Brett Kavanaugh and I went to the same prep school.
That's Georgetown Prep.
Georgetown Prep in Maryland. He went before I did. We didn't cross paths.
When I was in town, I spent much of my time working out, lifting weights, playing basketball, or hanging out and having some beers with friends as we talked about life and football and school and girls.
It was really interesting. The writer's room offices of Riverdale and Sabrina are in the CNN building. So you walk in the lobby, there's a million screens playing the news. And I remember vividly when the story broke that an accuser had stepped forward and accused Kavanaugh of sexual assault. I just read the headline and I immediately thought, I bet this is about when he was at Georgetown Prep.
I grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. I attended the Holton Arms School in Bethesda, Maryland, from 1978 to 1984. Holton Arms is an all-girls school that opened in 1901.
And I immediately thought of my play Good Boys, and there's one scene in the play, in the second act, where the accused and his victim, the girl, give testimony. And the hair on the back of my neck stood up, and it was mind-blowing.
We're talking with Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa about his play, Good Boys. I want to ask you about a couple of scenes. This is 1989, so it's pre-social media, but there's a video cassette of a sex tape, and there's a question about who is in it and whether or not the woman who is sexually assaulted in it is going to become a factor in the story. And there are two boys that are talking about the tape and about the woman who's in it, and one of them is named Brandon, the other one is named Justin. And Justin says, "So your plan is chilling in its simplicity and brilliance, except that, the girl on the tape is out there." And Brandon says, "She's not going to say anything."
I think when he says that line, he thinks, what could she possibly gain by coming forward? She's going to be embarrassed. I'm not going to be embarrassed. No one at the school where I go to cares about anything like that. You know, not only that, many of my friends do similar things like that. So the only person who's going to get in trouble or will be stained by this is the girl. That's his thinking, which of course is deeply, deeply disturbing and wrongheaded.
And that gets to kind of a bigger theme in the play, which is about entitlement and privilege and responsibility. The mother, Elizabeth Hardy, realizes that she might be part of the story in what she has allowed her son to believe about himself and the way that they operate separate from others. There are a lot of people who are having epiphanies in the course of this play, but I think Elizabeth Hardy, the boy's mom, is maybe having the most profound one about how the actions of her as a parent are coming back in some ways to haunt her.
Yeah, that I would say is one of the biggest revisions to the play over the last, you know, 15 years. Kind of the center of the play shifted a little bit from Brandon the boy onto Elizabeth, his mother. And I was really, really interested in Elizabeth's journey in which she has to recognize her own complicity in raising Brandon to be the kind of young man who would do something like this. Moreover, she's forced to examine actions she's done in the present and actions she's done in the past while she was a student at an all-girls prep school that are not too dissimilar from what Brandon did. And I think the blinders come off her in this play. It seems to be a perfect world that sort of starts unraveling. And she's driving that because she's trying to get to the truth of her son and herself.
Beyond being a playwright, you're a TV producer and writer and have worked in feature films as well. And you seem to have a very passionate interest in the darker side of adolescence.
Yeah.
It could be your film Carrie, it could be part of your comics in Archie, Riverdale, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on television. And I'm wondering, what is it about coming-of-age stories that you think gives you an opportunity to tell parables or share life lessons? And was that something you grew up wishing you could have had and feel it's important to have now? What's behind it?
I didn't sort of set out and say, you know, I'm just kind of interested in coming of age stories, but that is what I've been drawn to. And I think partly is because it's an inherently dramatic time in a person's life. It's that moment when you're leaving your childhood behind and you're taking your first steps as a young adult and you're finally, hopefully, experienced enough and developed enough that you can kind of figure out what kind of person you want to be when you grow up. It's also, you know, very dramatic. Everything is life or death. You know, you love and hate passionately. As for being drawn to the darker side of coming of age stories, you know, I kind of feel like I'm an optimistic guy and I'm an optimistic writer. So for instance, in Good Boys, even though terrible things happen in this play and terrible things are revealed about certain characters in this play, after the show, people in the lobby, they know I'm the playwright and they say, you know, what's going to happen to that boy and his mother? And I say, I hope that their story is just beginning and that they find some way to heal, to atone for what they've done. They find some way to understand what they did to each other and what they allowed themselves to do to other people. So even that play, even the play as dark as it is, and it does get dark, I believe there's a strain of optimism. And I think that's kind of true in Riverdale and Sabrina as well.
Good Boys is a play, and it really feels like it could be a TV movie or a feature film. Could it be?
Yeah, on and off, people have optioned it and talked about turning it into a movie because it does have an element of suspense and an element of mystery. And it does, you know, invite you into a hermetically sealed hothouse, you know, of an all boys prep school. I'd love to see that done. You know, I now have a little more clout because of the shows. So I do have dreams of turning it into a movie. Yes.
Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa is the playwright of Good Boys. It's at the Pasadena Playhouse now through July 21st. Roberto, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The 4th of July weekend is usually a big one at the box office, and there's a new Spider-Man movie that will probably bring in a ton of money.
You're a very difficult person to contact, Spider-Man.
But Peter Parker battling against Mysterio is not the holiday weekend's most important showdown. Instead,
go! Happy birthday, Alex Morgan!
It's the American women's soccer team in the finals of the Women's World Cup in France. They will play for the championship on Sunday. The tournament has been a ratings blockbuster. By the time the final whistle blows on Sunday, I'm predicting a U.S. win, 2-0. As many as 1 billion people around the globe will have tuned into the World Cup. But as popular as soccer is as a televised sport, it's really hard to think of a great soccer movie. And people will say, what about 2002's Bennett Like Beckham?
That was brilliant. You play for any side?
Think I'm good enough?
Yeah. Watch you a couple of times. You've gotten really good.
But Bennett Like Beckham is really a coming-of-age tale about rebellion, and the soccer scenes aren't much better than what you could see on the sidelines of an AYSO game. 10 years ago, Gael Garcia Bernal and Diego Luna starred in Rudo y Cursi.
Italy! Italy!
But that Spanish-language soccer movie received mixed reviews, and it didn't even gross $2 million at the box office. Yet, almost every other sport has at least one movie, if not several, that have been critical and commercial hits. Long-distance runners have Chariots of Fire, boxing has Creed, Raging Bull, Rocky, and Million Dollar Baby. And those last two movies, Rocky and Million Dollar Baby, like Chariots of Fire, won the Best Picture Oscar. Baseball has The Natural, 8 Men Out, and 2 classic Kevin Costner movies, Bull Durham and Field of Dreams.
If you build it, you will come.
Women in sports are notoriously ignored. Imagine that happening in Hollywood. But there are a couple of exceptions, like A League of Their Own, about an all-female baseball team.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris.
Football has North Dallas 40, Remember the Titans, The Blind Side. Hockey has Miracle and Slapshot. Basketball has Hoosiers. Golf has Tin Cup and Caddyshack.
This is a hybrid. This is a cross, bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, featherbed bench. And Northern California Sensimilla. The amazing stuff about this is that you can play 36 holes on it in the afternoon, take it home, and just get stoned to the bejesus belt.
Come on. It's a great movie. For horse racing fans, there's Seabiscuit. For billiards, there's The Color of Money. But when soccer's the game, Hollywood typically reduces the world's most popular sport to lowbrow comedies like Air Bud, World Pup.
I don't believe it. The U.S. has designated Buddy Fram to replace Scurry.
Frank, you're kidding. A dog?
Or slightly less stupid movies that are soccer versions of baseball's Bad News Bears, with comedians like Will Ferrell playing hapless coaches with hapless soccer teams. Here's Ferrell in Kicking and Screaming.
Okay, guys, I only want winners out on the field. Who's a winner? I said, who's a winner? Everyone's hand should be up.
I am.
Okay, everyone bring it in. All right, let's break someone's clavicle on three. One, two, three, break someone's clavicle! Hit the field. Let's go.
There was Victory, a 1981 movie from director John Huston that featured the pro soccer star Pele playing against the Nazis.
I want to play.
You can't play like that.
I feel good. I feel better. I must play.
Ref, he's coming back on.
But soccer was not the point of the movie. It was a POW escape drama. And Sylvester Stallone was the goalie, which pretty much says all you need to know.
Am I good? Or am I good?
What's your name?
You know my name.
Even when Hollywood starts with a good idea for a soccer movie, it misses the net. When 20th Century Fox turned Nick Hornby's fantastic soccer book Fever Pitch into a movie, the sport was changed from soccer to baseball.
You know, now she expects me to miss a Yankees game?
All right, Mr. Reitman, I got a bat. Let me just leave you with this thought. You love the Sox, but have they ever loved you back?
Now, granted, there are several challenges in making a great soccer movie. One thing, the country has been slow to embrace the sport, so maybe people in Hollywood are worried there's not an audience for a soccer movie, to which I would say, what about the dodgeball movie? People watch that.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
What? And even though soccer has some great individual players, it's still a team sport. Unlike football and baseball, there are no regular breaks where the audience can learn something about the athletes in the middle of the game. It's also really hard to capture on the big screen the artistry of what makes someone like Alex Morgan or Tobin Heath or Carly Lloyd so good. Their fakes and accelerations can happen in the blink of an eye. Can you make a movie by focusing on someone's feet? So maybe the best soccer story continues to be not what you might be able to see in some movie theater, but what you can watch right now on television. In other words, the real thing.
Low one and all the way in! A dream start for the United States! Girls, girls.
Coming up, the new series Mixed Dish is a comedy about what it means to grow up in a mixed-race family. We meet its showrunner, Karen Gist.
We really want to just focus on, you know, this awkward 12-year-old girl who's trying to fit in. But at the same time, we want to put some of these conversations about race and both sides of the coin on the table and really look at it in a way that hopefully will make people have the conversation outside of the show.
That's next on The Frame Weekend. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Imagine a 4th of July barbecue that starts off really well and goes very bad. It's a little bit like the movie Midsummer. It's about a group of people who travel to Sweden to this idyllic spot. It's always sunny, people are really nice, it's beautiful, and very quickly, bad things start happening. The movie is written and directed by Ari Aster. A year ago, he made a very successful little horror movie called Hereditary with Toni Collette. His new movie is in theaters right now.
I was going through a breakup at the time of writing the film, and I'm somebody who often kind of writes his way through a crisis, and I saw a way of marrying the breakup movie with the structure of a folk horror film.
I told you that I want to go to that festival in Sweden.
No, you said it would be cool to go.
Yeah, and then I got the opportunity and I decided
Look,
to do it.
I don't mind you going. I just wish you would have told me, that's all.
I consider myself a genre filmmaker. I love genre. I love working with sort of rigid frameworks that allow me to, blow up more personal stories. And so the idea was to make a sort of operatic breakup movie that is as large and heavy as a breakup feels.
And people who've gone through breakups, and I think that's probably pretty much who is living, knows that there are a couple of different feelings that you can have. One is incredible loss. One is incredible anger. And that suggests that there are very different ways of approaching the story that you're going to tell, whether or not it's going to be about loss or revenge. And I'm wondering, when you're thinking about the story about the breakup that you want to tell, was there a certain theme that you wanted to explore, especially about what Danny, played by Florence Pugh, is thinking as she's going through this breakup?
Certainly all the things you just mentioned. And you know, I do see the film as being sort of a horror movie about codependency.
Maybe I should just go home.
What? No, no. I'm just trying to understand.
And I'm trying to apologize.
And I don't need an apology. I don't. I just wanted to talk about it. That's all.
I really think I should just leave.
No. Please, please, please. I'm not trying to attack you.
It really feels like you are.
Well then I'm sorry. I just got confused.
And in the case of our main character, you know, I think the film really plays as almost a perverse wish fulfillment fantasy. But you know, I think if the film succeeds, you know, it's working up to a sort of euphoric ambivalence. And so it's a mediation between many different themes, and I guess this is my cryptic way of kind of avoiding being too explicit about what the film is doing so that people can have their own experience.
We're talking with writer-director Ari Aster about his new film, Midsommar. When I watched this movie, I never doubted for a minute that this place existed. It felt completely real. And I want to ask you about working with your production designer and some of your other department heads, because you have created this place, even though it is fictional, that feels incredibly realistic.
I did a lot of research. I went to northern Sweden with my production designer, Henrik Svensson, and we visited a lot of centuries-old farms. And I dove into, you know, research into Swedish tradition, Swedish folklore, different mythology. I learned the runic alphabet, the Uthark, as opposed to the Futhark. We had a brilliant costume designer, Andrea Flesch, who's a Hungarian artist. And you'll notice or the attentive viewer will notice that every article of clothing is covered in different runic symbols, as well as these very specific hieroglyphs that are actually a part of an invented language called the affect language, which I developed with my production designer and with our consultant, Martin Karlqvist. And that was a very long process that kind of was drawn out over the course of years. It was very important to me that this community be a place that, you know, you could really live in and feel, you know, enveloped by.
Unbelievable.
Welcome and happy midsummer. Skål!
But at the same time, I think it kind of becomes gradually more evident that this place is also, it kind of exists to serve and fulfill our main character's most primal needs and all the things that she's being denied throughout the film.
There is so much beauty in this film, and there's also tremendous darkness. There is some very serious life events, and there's also some humor. And I'm wondering how you figure out what that balance should be.
I do see the film as being a dark comedy, more so even in the overall trajectory of the film and its structure than in individual moments. Although I've been told that people find the film funny, and that's great, because that's certainly something that I wanted. But I love kind of jarring tonal shifts, and I love to not be on steady ground when I'm watching a film.
And finally, Midsommar or Midsommar?
I guess the correct way of pronouncing it would be Midsommar, but I've gotten into the habit of just calling it Midsommar, and Midsommar is also correct, so... You know, whatever makes you feel the least silly.
Ari Aster is the writer and director of Midsommar. Ari, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Midsommar, or Midsommar, whatever it's called, it's in theaters now. It's the Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. I have to admit, I'm not much of a gamer. My two sons are, but I find the business of gaming to be fascinating. The game market right now takes in more money than Hollywood, takes in more money than the music industry and streaming services, but it's not all blockbusters like Red Dead Redemption 2 or Call of Duty. Some independent developers are quietly making some quirky do-it-yourself games in the shadow of the major studios. Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited a collective in Culver City and has this story.
This is a video game called Dream Daddy. It's a dad dating simulator. Not exactly a conventional commercial video game, but that's the spirit at Glitch City, a collective of indie game artists and developers co-founded by Ben Esposito.
No one's making money from this. Like, this is just people trying to help other people make interesting art. And so I think if you're cool with the DIY, if you're cool with the empty weird warehouse, then you belong here.
It is a pretty empty warehouse, a small industrial space off Robertson Boulevard in Culver City that kind of feels like garage meets dorm room, complete with a string of Christmas lights draped overhead. Esposito started Glitch City in 2013 along with another Ben Vance.
at times we've described ourselves as kind of an art collective, a game collective, something in between, and we're not just trying to clone other games or like make games at any cost. You know, we're all trying to challenge it, the medium, in a different way, or to kind of take a different approach. And there is a DIY, kind of a little bit of a punk aesthetic.
Another founding member was Eric, who preferred not to give his last name.
I was just working at coffee shops a lot, and that was like my main way of like staying sane and keeping on task. But, you know, you don't have to work at a coffee shop alone. So it really just took me asking both the Bens to basically, let's just work at a coffee shop. And eventually that got called Strawberry Jam, which became kind of a precursor to Glitch City.
Today, Glitch City has a fluid group of about 24 citizens. But this isn't a video game company. Everyone here is making their own games, and many of them make their living as contract artists for other clients, like Rachel Sala.
People are like, hey, I need a logo, or I need some animation, or I need someone to skin this mini game for me. That's how I get most of my work.
Sala made the coffee today.
Make it basically every day. It's not good. You can drink it, though. It does the job.
Part of the benefit of Glitch City is that like doing your own project is very hard.
Brendan Chung used to work for a major game studio. Now he runs his own indie company out of Glitch City.
I have holes in my knowledge, and I could like look to my right and say, hey, take a look at this. What would you think about this? Everyone just kind of like understands where every project is, and we all can kind of like chip in and kind of give feedback on how everyone else is doing. There's something kind of magical there.
People aren't just developing games here. Candy Emberly is a composer.
So yeah, I'm writing music for a battle right now. We have all these different kinds of monsters, and you can have what's essentially a boss fight with any of them, and the hope is that it will all be recorded live at the end. That's a funding question.
Rather than corporate meetings, Glitch City does family dinners, as Eric explains.
It's a meeting, but more informal than a group meeting. Because if it was a true meeting, it'd just be chaos having, you know, like 20 people try to do some input towards that.
Eric's also being modest.
Here's Ben Vance again.
Because there's usually a giant dinner that's prepared, and it's often him or Rachel that are taking care of that. So there's a bunch of food and a bunch of sharing of what's going on in the space.
The games coming out of Glitch City are as diverse and quirky as its residents. Ben Esposito made a game called Donut County.
It's a game where you play as a hole in the ground, and you start really small, and you move it under stuff to make it fall in, and every time you eat something, it gets a little bit bigger. And so it's a game about kind of like scale and destruction and like what happens to a place over time as you like start to erase the things from it.
Eric's currently working on a game called Oft Horizon,
which is a seafaring exploration game. I've been working on it for many, many years, but not continuously and not full time. But it's about exploring a world that changes over time.
Last year, Brendan Chung released Quadrilateral Cowboy.
It's a far cry from the days of file cabinets and phone books.
You play as one of three ladies who are starting a startup company where companies hire you to hack other companies. So you're like guns for hire, basically. But instead of guns, you have computers. And it's set in this alternate 1980s universe, and everything's very clunky, everything's very analog.
Ben Vance is in the midst of developing a virtual reality experience called Irrational Exuberance.
Which is a deep space exploration. It's kind of like an experiment in ripping you out of, you know, your current reality and just throwing you out into deep space as yourself, and trying to make that sort of tangible.
And the first game Rachel Sala ever put out was called Frog Fractions.
Which is a comedy game. It has nothing to do with math. You won't learn anything if you play it. And it's about the joy of discovery and the spirit of exploration. So you do literally play as a frog, but you go into space, become president of Bug Mars, and silly things happen overall.
These are clearly all slightly idiosyncratic labors of love. I asked Rachel Sala, is this an exciting time to be an indie game developer? Or a scary one?
It's scary because there's a lot riding on it. There's always pressure to perform well and do well. And I think a lot of us here at this point are pretty far along in our careers, and we want to keep making successful games. And there's a lot of creativity out there. There's a lot of wild ideas. Almost every day there's some game that comes out. I'm like, oh, I wish I thought of that.
But Ben Vance says being a citizen of Glitch City means you don't have to truck it alone.
It's really hard making creative work. especially in a vacuum when you don't have anything to bounce your ideas off of. You know, staying motivated is one of the biggest things, and having a space for that, and people to, you know, connect with, talk to, and just even just like commiserate with, you know. What problems are you dealing with? Oh, yeah, that one.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
This is The Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. Over the summer, we're having a series of conversations with TV showrunners. We're getting their takes on the state of this ever-changing industry. Today, we're talking with Karen Gist. She worked on Girlfriends, she worked on Grey's Anatomy, and now she has a new series called Mixed-ish. It's kind of the origin story of Tracee Ellis Ross's character on Black-ish, Rainbow Johnson. It takes a look at her growing up as a child in a mixed-race household in the 1980s. Here's Karen Gist.
It is Rainbow Johnson, and Tracee will do the voiceover. So it's, you know, the adult Rainbow is looking back and thinking about all these things that help shape her.
And when we got to school, we got introduced to the real world.
I'm too little to die!
Real quick.
What are you weirdos mixed with?
What's mixed?
My parents had sent us out into the world with absolutely no warning that being mixed was even a thing. Imagine being the new kid when no one in the world is like you. But you have to understand, today's mixed kids can look up to rappers, ballerinas, athletes, a president, and a princess. The only heroes we had were DeBarge.
It's a little bit of Wonder Years. There's a little bit of a, like a gooey heart center to the show. But we really want to just focus on, you know, this awkward 12-year-old girl who's trying to fit in. But at the same time, we want to put some of these conversations about race and both sides of the coin on the table and really look at it in a way that hopefully will make people have the conversation outside of the show.
It feels like if you look at some of your credits, Girlfriends, Grey's Anatomy, Star, Mixed-ish, that there are a lot of very strong, independent women at the centers of the shows that you are working on. And I suspect that's not random.
That is not random. I tend to be drawn to, I'm drawn to stories about others, people who feel a little marginalized. I love a strong woman who has some big decision to make or somebody who's trying to figure it out, because that's who I am. All the time, no matter how successful I am, I'm always just trying to navigate and figure out who I am and where I fit in and what I'm supposed to say and what my purpose is. And so for me, having a character who is constantly questioning and growing and giving and writing that from the point of view of a strong woman is just something that I seek out and I'm drawn to.
We're talking with Karen Gist. She's a TV writer and producer and the showrunner of the upcoming series Mixed-ish. I want to ask you about the lessons that you have learned about collaboration, because you have worked with some really interesting people. I'm wondering, what are the lessons that you have taken away from some of your collaborators, less about like how to structure a plot and how to tell a story versus how to work with other writers and be collaborative, but also make sure that the vision of what it is you're trying to do isn't diluted by all the other voices around you?
The biggest lesson I've learned, and this is a lesson in life too, like never lead with ego, like take ego out of everything. And once you do that, I think it's easier to collaborate and hear everyone. And one of the first lessons I learned in a room was on Girlfriends. If a pitch isn't taken, it doesn't mean the pitch is bad. It just means the pitch isn't good for what we're doing right now. And I think a lot of writers can get really, writers are sensitive beings who love lunch. That's what we do. But, you know, this idea that something wasn't taken in a room can be silencing in a way and remove a writer from the conversation. And when you really think about what that is, that's just a bruised ego. And so across the board, from a staff writer to a showrunner to a creator, I think everyone has to come to the table wanting to lift the project up. And, you know, the best thing to me in a room is the alley-oop. I think you lift an idea up and you hope
somebody else can slam dunk it
or just move it, you know, move it along a little bit. And then if it eventually is a clunker, it falls and that's fine. But I think think what I've learned from working with some of the heavier hitters in the business is it's about the work, about the project. And, you know, what Lee used to say all the time, you protect the baby.
If you looked at a photo gallery of network TV writers' rooms and even network TV casts from 10 years ago to today, you would see a fundamental difference in a lot more women and people of color, both behind the scenes and on screen. Still not enough, but certainly an improvement. You've been there for some of that.
I don't know. It depends.
You think it's been fractional. How would you assess where we've come and how far we still have to go?
I think we have a long way to go. Yes, there are more television shows that are focused on people of color. And so then we have, you know, a lot of writers' rooms where we have writers of color or diverse writers in those rooms especially. But I don't think that the more traditional shows actually have really diverse rooms. And that's because the ability to pull someone up is, you don't have that ability if there isn't someone at the top to do it. And I think we have a long way to go in terms of getting more women and people of color across the board in positions of power to then reach back and pull up.
We need more Shondas. We need more Kenyas. We need more Lees.
We need more co-EPs, more we need more story editors and producers, people who continue to come up through the ranks so that they can become the Shondas or the Kenyas.
Karen Gist, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Matthew Cherry used to catch footballs in the NFL. Now he's pitching stories in Hollywood. He's now making an animated film that challenges stereotypes of black men. That's next on The Frame Weekend. It's a Frame Weekend, and I'm John Horn. If you hear people say they got knocked around in Hollywood, Matthew Cherry can say, you should have seen my first job. Cherry is now a creative executive at Jordan Peele's company, but he used to be a professional football player. Right now, he's working on an animated short film called Hair Love. It's about a black father doing his daughter's hair for the first time. And while Hair Love, the short film, is being made, Cherry turned the idea into a children's book that is out now.
So, yeah, we did a Kickstarter for a short film.
Right.
And then the book was one of the gifts that we offered. And then we ended up getting a book deal through that.
Before we talked about the book, we talked about his early days in Hollywood, where he started as low man on the totem pole.
Like, when I moved to L.A., I started as a PA. Like, I didn't even tell people I played sports the first 2 years I was in L.A. just because I wanted to, like, I'm Matthew, the PA. I'm here to learn, and I want to learn this from the ground up. So, yeah.
So let the work speak
exactly.
for itself.
I kind of use my position as a PA to kind of forward myself as a director. And so when I learned that I wanted to be a director, I was working on this NBC show called Heroes.
I can't explain it, but I know I'm supposed to be somebody. I feel like there's something inside me that wants to come out. Does that make any sense?
Kind of used being a PA as my film school. And so I went to all the heads of the departments. I was like, hey, I'm thinking about becoming a director. Would you guys be okay if I borrowed equipment, if I was able to book a shoot on the weekends? And they were like, yeah, that's fine. But if you get caught up, that's on you. And like this,
I didn't say yes.
And this is where the radio stuff kind of came into play. So because I had started in radio, I started subscribing to Billboard magazine. And like, this is like 2007 or 2008. And I started like studying all the songs that were charting in the field of music that I wanted to direct music videos in. And that was R&B. And so every time a song would chart that was new, I would go cross-reference it on YouTube. And then MySpace was the popular social media site at the time. And I would reach out to these artists on my lunch breaks and basically write a treatment. And I would reach out to him and be like, hey, you don't know me from a can of paint. My name is Matthew. I'm currently a PA on the show. I have access to the equipment, though. Like, this is an idea I have for a music video for you. And, you know, like, if you can get to L.A., like, I'll shoot it for you for free,
wow.
basically. And so I just kind of use, like, being a PA as kind of, like, my end to, like, get access to equipment and to kind of start shooting my first couple of jobs. And it ended up working out.
So I have to ask you about your book, Hair Love.
Uh-huh.
What was its inspiration?
You know, I was coming across all these videos on social media of like fathers interacting with their kids. The thing that would always overperform was fathers and daughters. And it kind of ended up being this double-edged sword where like, of course, the videos were cute, but I found out after a deeper dive that it was because people weren't used to seeing Black fathers interacting with their kids in this way. In my experience, all my friends that are, you know, young fathers, like, you know, all that gender kind of norm thing, like, it's out the window. Like, if a dad has to get their kid ready or do the hair, make them breakfast, they do it because they have to. And that's because mom had to go to work early. So, you know, for me, I just wanted to show us doing some things that, you know, I think the perception is that it's not normal, but for most people, you know, you got to do what you got to do when you love your kid. And yeah, it kind of came from that.
We're talking with filmmaker Matthew Cherry about his children's book, Hair Love. I want to ask you to read two pages from the story. This is basically kind of the setup for what's going to happen next. I want you to read these two pages, then we'll talk about what we see in the illustrations.
Okay, great. So Daddy was still sleeping. Shh, I said to Rocky as we tiptoed past him. Lately, Daddy has been worn out. He makes me breakfast, takes me to school, goes to work, picks me up, and yesterday we went for a bike ride around the park. I think he needs a break.
Daddy's crashed out.
Yep.
He's been working hard. He has tattoos. His hair is in locks. It's a very intentional illustration that you have come up with. How did you work with your illustrator, and what was important that you wanted to represent visually in the story?
Well, yeah, you know, I think it's crazy. Like, when we did the Kickstarter initially, like, the dad was, like, I call him, like, safer. He was, like, older. He didn't have any tattoos. He looked like a typical dad that you would see on the street. And, you know, when we started working with Penguin Random House and Coquila Books, like, it was, like, really important to kind of push, like, different stereotypes to kind of overcome them. And so, for me, I was like, man, what type of Black man is kind of perceived as like the biggest threat. And it is like, you know, younger Black men with tattoos and, you know, things that if you saw him get on an elevator, you wouldn't expect him to be a young father that does his daughter's hair. And then in that image that I just read from, you know, just kind of showing that he's a dad that is very active in his daughter's life and, you know, gets exhausted at the end of the day. You know, something I think as simple as depicting Black children and Black men and Black parents as resting, you know, when a lot of our stories have to be so much about us saving the world or like being involved in civil rights or trying to get involved with movements. You know, just a simple act of that, I think, is just so bold, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you're in production on turning it into an animated short film.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you say that process has been? And what has been your role in working in a hugely collaborative environment when you're making an animated film? You go from like 10 people to 100 people really quickly.
Yeah, well, you know, our situation is kind of unique. You know, it's kind of more like an indie production, and we're partnering with Sony Pictures Animation. So, you know, it's just been this really great collaborative process where we got two other directors that are on it now because animation is new to me that I don't know how to do. Like, they're able to really pick up the slack. But at the end of the day, storytelling is storytelling, and you want to make sure that things are authentic. But this is different from indie filmmaking in that, you know, you have to build a world from scratch, and it's just been a really cool process, and we're plugging away, and we got a hard deadline coming up in a couple of weeks, and so we're trying to make sure that we make it.
Matthew Cherry is a writer and a director. His children's book, Hair Love, is out now, and his short film, based on the book,
coming soon.
You're listening to Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. I'm joined now by Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett, who has come downstairs bearing musical gifts. What'd you bring?
This is an interview with John Holliday. He is what's known as a countertenor. In opera, it's the highest male voice.
So I know, like, there's a vocal range for boys' choirs, and they eventually age out of that when their voices change. How old is John Holliday?
Right. John Holliday, I think, is in his early 30s. He just kind of has a natural gift for singing high. But you'll hear his speaking voice is normal. And when I talked with him, he just had some great stories about how he even got into opera in the first place. He wasn't really on track to become an opera singer, but he's now pioneering some of, I think, the coolest works for his vocal range in opera today.
Around the age of 11 or 12 years old, I was in a boys' choir called the Fort Bend Boys Choir of Texas, and we were singing in The Damnation of Faust, and Denise Graves was Marguerite. I was one of the boy soloists who sang a small little solo line, and I remember her being so beautiful, and she was wearing these beautiful gowns. I've always loved fashion. And I was like, can I go and see your dressing room? Can I see all your beautiful gowns and your dresses and your shoes? And she let me do it. had never seen an African-American, or really for that matter, a person of color singing opera. And so at the moment I saw Denise Graves, I thought, okay, this means that I can do it. And in a lot of ways, I feel like she gave me permission. So I was around 11 or 12 years old. But anyway, yeah, got in high school. And as a freshman, I was singing as a soprano in high school. And the sopranos who were in choir, there were very few of them who were very nice. But I would take all the solos. The shock of being a countertenor, I think, when people hear me, is that you have to kind of explain, what kind of voice is it? Is there something that's wrong here? Is that really you singing? And so that's always my answer. It's like, well, yes, it's really my voice. It's not a falsetto. This is my real voice. It's not far, just close by, through an open door. I didn't know what a countertenor was. I didn't know there was a term. What I always just thought was what it was, a male soprano, you know, because it is not uncommon to hear in the African-American church men singing up there. But it's not called a countertenor. But this, of course, now is, you know, it's the proper term. I am a missionary Baptist. You know, that's what I grew up in. My grandmother was a music minister at my church. She sang lots of gospel music. She also loved Aretha Franklin, so I heard a lot of Aretha Franklin growing up, a lot of soul music. My grandmother was very, very adamant with me about my learning of music, because I was wanting to be exactly like her, and I was like, Big Mama, I call my grandmother Big Mama. I said, Big Mama, how'd you learn this? She said, the same way you're going to learn it. And I was like, well, how is that? She says, on your own. I was talking to my teacher, Barbara Hill Moore, at Southern Methodist University, and I'd seen my very first opera ever. I saw Rigoletto, and I fell in love with Caro Nome. And so I went to my teacher and I said, Prof, I call my teacher Prof. I say, Prof, I can sing really, really high, and let me show you. She's like, no, you really can't. And I said, well, yes, I really can. So she's like, okay, let me hear it. And she says, oh, you are what we call a countertenor. She told me, you know, if this is what you want to do, you have to really become dedicated to your craft. You have to become really dedicated to research. And listen. Vivi, tirano, il tuo scampato. The repertoire of a countertenor is typically repertoire dealing with music in the Baroque period. We have Johann Sebastian Bach. We have Mozart. Vivaldi. Ooh, I love Vivaldi, too. Sorry, I got excited talking about Vivaldi. But, of course, lots of Handel. With the contemporary music that's being written, I find that it is generally music that has tough subject matter or something where they want an ethereal sound. I've done two new works. I've done Huang Ruo's Paradise Interrupted, where I represent one of the forces of nature in the world. Then in Daniel Bernard Humain's We Shall Not Be Moved, I am the character of a female-to-male trans person in this opera. Say black and hear yes. And it's also to create this kind of haunting, yet soulful and beautiful sound. The John Holliday Experience is a show that brings together all of the music of my life. Summertime. It has a combination of classical music, jazz, spirituals, gospel music. The show brings to the forefront all of me. I am unashamed of who I am as a gay, black, Christian man existing in this body with this voice. I get on the stage and unapologetically give everything that I have. and just having people be in it with me on the journey, it means so much to me. I love to sing. I love to bring joy to other people. When I'm on the stage and I can see someone, and I do, I can see when someone comes into a room with like the weight of the world on their shoulders. And I think it's my responsibility to kind of lift it a little bit.
One of these mornings, you're gonna rise up soon. Then you spread your wings and you take to the sky.
That is our show for this holiday weekend. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin. Valentina Rivera is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. Our intern is Paul Ratliff, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. Our theme music is by Taylor McFerrin. I'm John Horn. From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, have a great rest of your weekend. We'll be back with the daily version of The Frame on Monday.